Welcome to the Inside College Soccer Podcast, bringing together some of the best college soccer-related people to your earbuds, from coaches to players and beyond. So, thank you for tuning in. The Inside College Soccer Podcast is brought to you by Sports Recruiting USA, the college soccer experts. Now, enjoy the show.
Right on, Steven. Good to have you on the podcast. It's crazy. We were just talking off the air. What a small world the college soccer world is, that we're just here. You are in the middle of the country. And while we followed each other on social media, we've never really talked. And in 30 seconds, we started drawing the connections of 1 degree of separation between us.
Truly, truly 1 degree of separation, it feels like, amongst all coaches in America.
Yeah, people don't understand that, which is why I tell kids and parents and stuff, stop talking crap about other coaches and programs and stuff on social media, even youth coaches. Mm-hmm. Don't do it. Don't get involved. It may not work out well for you because somebody knows somebody and we're pretty closely connected.
Yeah, absolutely. That's good advice you're giving. Hopefully they
good,
listen.
Good. So you're, for those who are just listening, you're at Missouri St. Louis now, huh?
Yeah.
Fairly recent. You're going into your second season, I guess, yeah. Right?
Yes, correct. I joined staff in late June, moved out here with my wife at the end of July, and about 2 weeks later, we started preseason. So I'm in my first spring with the team as well, which is great, just to lay out some foundation and some blueprints for growth this spring and utilizing the spring season. We had a phenomenal run last year. The goal, of course, is to reach that Elite Eight game again, hopefully move past it and make a Final Four, maybe a run for a national championship. So great to have the spring season with the team to continue to layer in culture and individual growth and development, you know, at this time of the year.
Yeah. So tell everybody that doesn't know where you guys compete in and how it's different than the D1 world that you came from.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're NCAA Division II. We're in the GLVC. So a lot of our opponents are Missouri, Illinois. We play up in Iowa, some Kansas. So we're really in the middle of the country, but a really, really high level conference. The GLVC sent four teams to the NCAA tournament this past fall, and you know, having spent some time at Division One, there's a lot of separation just in the Division One world between the different programs, you know, the Power Fours versus the mid majors, and what I can share with the conference and the team at UMSL. I mean, we're a high level Division Two team, and it's a really competitive level. Even teams in our conference that, you know, were more towards the bottom of the table, middle of the table, I mean, there was good players, good coaches. There's no easy game, and we play 14 conference games, so it's a real battle to get through the conference, to hopefully make a conference tournament and make the NCAA. But was really impressed with the level of play of the GLVC this past fall.
One of my good friends is Michelle over at Baylor, who won, you know, at Dallas, won Division II championships, multiple ones, and she's talked about going from there to now being Big Ten, and how difference in recruiting is going up, different kinds of players that you need to recruit to compete at the Power Four level, Division I. What have you noticed now coming from, you know, your experience at Nevada, Reno, and at Denver, now having to go down to now having to recruit at the Division II level? Mm-hmm. What have you noticed in the differences of the types of players that you recruit?
Yeah, good question. I think for UMSL, we're probably a little bit more regional base, focusing our attention really on the St. Louis based players. The Kansas City players were 4 hours from Chicago, or about 4 or 5 hours from Milwaukee, about 4 from Indianapolis. So we're focusing more on that in the more of the local region. That's just budgetary reasons too. You know, we don't have the Division I budget to be flying across the country to all like the ECNL events. So I think there's a lot more of local base recruiting. In terms of the type of athlete, I mean, there's still great players at Division II. There's great athletes. I mean, several players on our team were recruited to the Division I level. Could have played Division I, maybe chose Division II. Just more of the I would say well-rounded student athlete, one that's looking for more of the soccer piece, the academic piece, the social piece. I mean, certainly in the fall, there's really not much of a difference between Division I, D2, D3, junior college in terms of the amount of training, the amount of games. Obviously, the travel is going to be a little bit different between the different levels. But we really are looking for student athletes that are focused on grades, that are going to focus on getting a degree in hopefully 4 years. Certainly, Division II players, there's an opportunity for some of them to go professionally. But I would say a majority of the Division II players, you know, are looking to really have an enriching and transformative experience with college soccer, and then, you know, onto their you know, finishing their degree, and then onto the next chapter in their life. So I really have enjoyed Division II, and again, I think you're recruiting a more well-rounded student athlete. And I just think there's less turnover as well amongst rosters at Division II. Players more inclined to join a program and want to stay at a program for all 4 years. Of course, if the environment is worthy of keeping a player for 4 years. So I think, again, you're looking at players who maybe are a little bit more driven by the team, driven by the university. I'm probably generalizing a little bit here. Of course, there's Division I, Division III that focus on all those things as well, but that is something that I have really that's really drawn me to Division II, having spent some time at, you know, Division I and also at D3 at the beginning of my year coaching career.
No, I don't think you're wrong, Stephen. I think that I'm hoping it settles down. I think the excitement of NIL money. I mean, I've talked to we've got a friend of ours who's a, I won't say the name and I won't say the school, but he won national championships at the D1 level, and he says it's frustrating that the very first question many of the recruits are asking is how much playing time will you guarantee me and how much money will you give me? So the focus has become on what can you do for me, not what can I do for the team. And you know, it's so I've said this so many times, Stephen. I think Division One on the women's side is striated into at least nine different levels. You know, we have the elite of the elite. We have the same five, six schools that you can name preseason that are going to win the national championship. I mean, if you gave you see it happen on the men's side once in a while. You see the Akrons and the you know that'll pop in there, and then Marshall came up out of nowhere, and then
Vermont's really good.
Vermont. You'll see these outliers that win on the men's side. You don't see that on the women's side. I don't know when the last time we saw an outlier win an NCAA Division I women's national title on the women's side. It's been I don't know when. It's the same schools over and over. So you have that level. Then you have the I want to be at that level, but I know I will never be at that level, but I'm really close. You know, we make the tournament every year, but we don't, you know, we rarely get past the Elite Eight, if ever. And then you have the level that wants to be in the tournament. Then you have the level that wants to win a conference title. Then you have the level that hopes to win a conference title or be in the conference championship. And then you've got the schools that will never be in a conference championship, will never even finish over 500 ever, have never done it in the program history, you know. And then you've got the schools that can barely, Division I schools on the women's side, that can barely fill a roster. Right. So I say there's probably nine different levels at the women's, and on the men's side, there's probably six different levels that are striated within it. And while Division Two has that and Division Three has that on the women's side, I don't think it's striated into nine levels. I think it's becomes it's having coached at Cal State East Bay in the CCAA, which I would argue is as strong as any conference in the country.
Yeah,
If you know,
absolutely.
some argue this, if you're in the conference, you say it's the strongest, but you know, it's just arguably one of the better ones. You know, as you said, in your conference, even the worst teams, you think you're walking in for an easy game, you're going to get upset.
A hundred
You're going to
percent.
get beaten. That doesn't happen as much at the women's, but Women's Division One level, I think, like I say, I think it's more striated. And possibly because there's too many schools. I think maybe for the amount of Division One talent is, there shouldn't be, there are some schools that just should not be Division One competing at the Division One institutional level, I think is part of it. And I think the other part of it is on the women's side. And you having been a men's college collegiate player, tell me what you think. But I think we don't have enough female players to fill the roster spots when we talk about what a collegiate player should be. I mean, I coached at the junior college level, and I absolutely had rostered players on good teams that they could barely play. The women could barely play. They were not good. They were shockingly bad at how bad those it. But I needed to fill my rosters.
Right,
So
absolutely.
I will take anybody, and there are schools, many, many schools, more on the women's side in this country where that's the case. I don't know. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I certainly the parity at Division Two, Division Three is a bit of, I would say, the top to the bottom. It's a little bit tighter than, I mean, I've never heard it described as the nine tiers of D1, but I absolutely would second that thought, Don. It's very true. Just the few schools. I mean, even my last year at University of Denver, our men's team went coached by Jamie Franks. They went to the Final Four, and lost to Vermont. It was a, Denver was a really unique school because it was more of that upper mid-major. We didn't have the Power Four football or things like that, but we're competing against schools like that. And yeah, on the men's side, they make it, they're making it to the Final Four, lose to Vermont, and I mean, that's a battle of two mid-majors. So I think, yeah, I think there's no excess of internationals, for example, male 24, 25-year-old male student athletes that are willing to, I didn't make it pro in England, so let me go fill every D2, D3, JUCO roster in the US. And I think, probably a little bit more again on the women's side. There seems to be more of a focus on the team and the experience and how that experience is going to propel me into the next chapter of my life. I think that's probably why junior college women's programs, there's of course the reputation of, oh, you just go to JUCO if you have bad grades. That's probably hurt a little bit on the women's side. I mean, you coached in it, and I have recruited every year from junior college. We just added a region player of the year locally here to our roster this January. That is not the case for most, but there's a lot of that stigma that probably is hard to overcome, and particularly more on the women's side.
You're so right, and I that stigma is you have. I think parents and I want parents and players to ask themselves, where is that stigma coming from, and why is it stopping your kid from doing what's right for them? Is it more important to you as a parent or a player that you look good to your friends and look good on social media? Is that more important than just doing what's the right thing for your child? Because you talk about that player that you're talking about right there. I had a client last year who, decided to go to junior college and then won a couple of state titles and now is making an immediate impact to her team that the minute she stepped on the field at the D1 level at Sacramento State, made an immediate impact to the team. And I'm going to argue very strongly with and that she would not have made that immediate impact at the Division One level had she not had that junior college experience.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you
It's
can
and
go
that's
and sit. It's just
yeah.
hard for a freshman. Men, male, female, moving away from home sometimes, quite often, having to settle in, having now to play against, even if in a perfect world, against only a 22-year-old senior or 21-year-old senior is. Who has 100 college games under their belt, it's hard to beat that player out. So you're going to have to pay your dues. And I just hate the stigma of the junior college being something lesser than rather than being a stepping stone.
Yeah, absolutely. And our goalkeeper coach, Eric Walker here, was recruit local player, was recruited. Played at Kentucky his freshman year, transferred. I think his next move was to St. Louis University, and then played junior college. And I might have gotten the timing of when he was at which school, incorrect, but I know that he has mentioned his favorite experience, the best time he had was at the junior college level. Because again, I think experience and environment are what matters most. The reason why you've got so many players in the transfer portal every single, window that opens, we'll have another one opening here in middle of May, is because the experience and the environment that they're in is clearly not working. It's clearly not ticking the boxes that those student athletes, those players are looking for. And I think, again, regardless of JUCO, D3, D2, D1, going and having a positive experience, it almost seems like the abnormal thing nowadays with college soccer, that you actually are enjoying your college soccer experience, that you're enjoying your coaching staff, that you feel you have a coaching staff that really cares for you and believes in you. When you hear these stories of positivity, it's like, oh, that's refreshing to hear, because oftentimes we're hearing, I didn't get a chance. And again, there's two sides to every coin, of course. But a lot of it is more on the negative side. Didn't get the experience that they were told or hoping for. And of course, that's so sad to hear, because college soccer is such an enriching life experience when it's done right.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I it's funny, last podcast I did was with Jamie Clark, who, University of Washington won the national championship. And it's easy for us to blame one side or the other. I mean, the parents want to blame the coaches want to blame the players. It's all a combination of both, and there's plenty of blame to go around. I mean, there are coaches out there that are not giving players enough time to develop and just cutting them loose. They want immediate success from the players. And then there's players out there who aren't giving themselves enough time to progress. But to the players, who I am the most concerned about, because I think players are in more control than they realize. My advice to players is, when you have your end of the season meeting, do not walk in with, what do I need to do to get more playing time? Because the coach is likely going to tell you these days, maybe it's just best that you transfer. They don't want to spend time with you dealing with it. But if you walk in with, coach, I understand that I got a lot of work to do, and what I want to do is help, get, need from you is to help me develop a plan so that I can become an impactful player to help the team win. Instead of what can I do to get more playing time, rephrase it with the coaches. Don't put them on the defensive, and try to get a plan from them and help them understand that if it takes a year or two for me to develop, then that's what it takes. But I'm here to support the team. That less coaches would be asking players to leave if that were the tack that the players take. So again, I'm here to educate the players, not blame them. Not blaming players, I'm just trying to educate them and their families to think about this as a team sport, not as an individual sport, and it's all about me. Instead, it's about the team and what can I do to make the team better. I don't know. At least for me, Stephen, I don't know how you feel. I mean, you're an experienced coach. You've been around a long time at a lot of levels. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I like the advice that you're giving them, and saying that the players have more ownership than they probably think. And I think a big thing, especially like this first spring with our UMSL team here, where we don't play our first game for another 5 weeks. We're in our 8 hour window, so it's not as frenetic and not as hectic as the fall. With the phrase of own your development, do not wait for a coach or a teammate to motivate you. And of course, my job as their head coach and our staff is to guide them and to be a resource for them. We're doing individual development plans, IDPs, with every single one of our players. Having them set SMART goals, having them look at the four phases of the game and where their strengths are, where their areas of growth are, and again, giving them the blueprint to be successful. But at the end of the day, it's got to be their dream, not mine. And the more I'm around this generation of players, they're highly sophisticated. They're so savvy. Their whole lives obviously have been built on technology, which of course we want to start use that as a tool for our advantage in coaching. But I mean, it's a totally different ball game with kids these days. As Betsy Butterick, one of the books I've read recently, and about how we can utilize and make this generation of players like our competitive advantage. Because I think a lot of coaches, for one, they're under an immense amount of pressure to get results. That's probably when you talk about coaches being they maybe being a little too quick to, I don't want to say give up on a player, but not get in the weeds with them about here's where you're at and here's two or three things to really grow on and if you want to meet once a week and do some extra training, let's do some extra trainings and really co-create that development. But again, going back to the feedback to our players is, when you have more control over your life, I think the people who wake up and they think, the coach is against me, the team doesn't like me, the world is against me. I think that's just such a sad way to live. And so really trying to take ownership for your life. And I think, again, at this age, when you're coaching 18 to 22-year-olds, there's so much growing. And that's why I love coaching at the college game. I think about myself and being in their shoes and just, needing guidance and needing someone that really believes in them and says, hey, this is where you're at, but this is where I think you can be. And let's work together to get there. That's the culture I really have tried to bring into this UMSL team. And again, the players, like, don't make excuses. Own your stuff. We all have stuff that we gotta own. Let's create a safe environment where we're owning it. Mistakes are gonna happen, but they're not defining us, and we're moving on and we're progressing together.
I love it. I love it. You brought up you mentioned your spring. And for those that are listening that wonder, what's the difference between Division One and Division Two? As you said, during season, none, zero. I mean, depending on what conference you're in, I mean, clearly if you're Stanford or Washington's,
Traveling
University of
across.
Washington, your travel is it's a horrific schedule, frankly. You're traveling coast to coast nowadays. It's crazy that we have West Coast teams in the ACC, but we do,
I
here
don't get
we
it either. I
are.
thought the Atlantic Ocean was on the other side, but.
Here we are. But besides that there's no difference in season, virtually none. Everybody's working just as hard, putting in the hours. It's insane. It's 60 hours a week as a student and an athlete during season, plus sometimes if you want to count the travel. But in the spring, what's the difference between what you can do with your players and then how, as a Division II coach, how can you make it feel like a Division I experience and stay within the rules at the same time?
Good question. I know Division One, like at Denver in our spring seasons, in the first bits, we were still in kind of the 8 hour window, just like we're at Division Two. And again, those 8 hours are you're allowed maximum of 4 hours with the ball. That's like your normal training session, and then 4 hours without the ball. The spring is certainly a time for us where we really start to focus more in the weight room. And the fall is very hard with the season. I mean, we're just muscle maintenance is really the name of the game in the fall. We're not trying to add weights and improve our maxes, but in the spring, absolutely, this is a great time for us to get quicker, stronger, faster, more explosive. So we really maximize where we're going 4 times a week with our strength coach here, an hour times four to hit our 4 hours there. In the for the 4 hours with the ball, we're training twice a week. It's been cold here in St. Louis. It's just starting to warm up, so we've been inside. We do futsals on Thursdays. We call it Futsal Thursdays. We have something called Champions Table here. It's basically just taken from Anson Dorrance's, competitive cauldron, where we're tracking goals, blocks, goals allowed, wins, and we kind of keep a table active throughout Futsal Thursdays, as we call it here, just so we're trying to. I mean, we have to compete in every training. The spring can feel long for the players because, again, the fall, you start preseason on Monday. I mean, for us this year, we started on Monday. We played Wash U on Thursday. I mean, that's 3 days into practice. We got our first game. In the spring, our first game is March 10th. Some teams might not play till the end of March. So you've got a good, like, 2 months sometimes where you're trying to keep them motivated. And of course, at the end of the day, that every player loves the game and wants to play the game. So we try to find ways to drive competition and training. But yeah, the difference is, and I don't know if Division One has changed. I mean, I was with the staff at Denver last spring, but maybe before when I did 9 years at MSUB, maybe Division One had a little bit more time. But certainly it feels very, very similar in the time frame. I mean, I'm just utilizing a lot of what we did at Denver. Hey, this worked great. Let's keep this going for our team here. We are required 2 days off for the players. So again, the spring is opportunity for them maybe to take some harder classes. If they're going to miss training, it's certainly would prefer them missing a training session in the spring versus missing a training session in the fall. So if they have a class that conflicts, can they take it in the spring? And then a lot of our players at Division II level, I mean, they work. They have to work to help pay for school. And so, we really are try to give them the schedule in early January when we meet and try to keep to that schedule as much as possible. They all have lives outside of soccer. I think it's so important that coaches remember that it is my life that is I'm still women's soccer right now, and it's my job, and it's why I'm here with my family. But for our players, it's part of their lives. And I think being aware of that and respecting their time outside of the sport will help them really lock in and really focus on what's happening, and when we are together as a team.
Oh no, 100%. And the other thing that players have to understand and parents have to understand is that team culture plays a lot into the spring. As far as you talk about while your strength trainer can only be with them 4 days a week, that doesn't preclude a player from going into the gym on their own
Correct.
or using the wall on their own or them playing games on their own, getting the team together on their own. It precludes none of that. So it's just it can't be staff driven. But nobody's saying the players have to stand around the rest of the time and do no soccer. No soccer is allowed. It just has to be player driven on their own. The coach can't be directing it, setting up the facilities, things like that. The players have to drive that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that brings the team even closer together. Again, these IDPs that we're going through, a lot of them, they want to improve their touches, their technical ability. They want to re improve, receiving the ball in the half turn. It's like we in training will go through like a technical progression since we're inside a ball, one player, one ball, the wall. And we show them in training, hey, this is could you replicate this on your own? Could you come in with a teammate into, the rec center and for 20 minutes both of you work and you get 1,000 touches on the ball. And part of their IDP goals is, hey, 2 times a week, I want to do extra touches. I want to work on ball striking. And again, them working together is only going to drive the culture and only going to drive their connectivity and their inclusion within the group. When I played at Frostburg D3 in Western Maryland, we were so excited in the off season. Now Division Three has a different beast when it comes to what they're allowed to do. They get one play day, at least this is certainly how it was when I was a player, maybe 30 days of training. I mean, it's a really condensed schedule. Again, goes just back to the D3 philosophy. But at Frostburg, we certainly weren't getting outside in January and February in the mountains of Maryland. We would play pickup with the women's team. And when I think about my time there, I mean, it was that we were inside. We would use There was like an auxiliary room that had desks, but also space. We put two desks together for goals, put shoes for goals. It was just a pure love for the game at that point. You didn't need the fancy mannequins and the shooting nets that have the corners picked out for you to target. It was just the ball and your friends, your teammates, and it was such a, I mean, it's what I remember most and what I enjoyed most about my time as a student athlete. And again, that wasn't coach driven. The coach did not have to ask us, hey, you guys need to go play, pickup. It was just us loving the game and wanting to play and be a part of it. And again, I think that's such a, if the environment of the team in season is one that the players love being a part of and they want to come to training and they're having fun at training, I am a full believer that is the competitive advantage. You can play with joy and intensity. Both can exist at the
100%.
same time. And I think that's what drives me the most about if I have created an environment as a coach where the players are enjoying coming to training. I'm not going to be, not every coaching point I make is going to be on cue or perfect, the timing of it, the decisions that we make, the drills that we run, or the activities. But at the end of the day, if they're enjoying coming to training and they are like, wait, practice is over? It's like, okay, we're doing the right thing here. We want them coming back for more. And that is, again, what's going to help drive that individual development that we're really hoping for this spring.
Yeah, I love it. I couldn't say it. I couldn't say it any better. I don't do not like it when players obfuscate their own responsibility, throw away their own responsibility to an environment. They say, "Well, the coach didn't motivate me." I mean, it's kind of a joke, but it's not a joke, and people think I'm harsh when I say it. You know, I had somebody ask me, said, "What do you do to motivate your players?" And I said, "If I have to motivate my players, I get new players. I want players that are motivated because of the love of the
Absolutely.
game, because they can't get enough soccer. They want to play. They're motivated to get better because they love the game and they want to get better. If I've got to sit there and be their rah-rah cheerleader to motivate them, and what I do doesn't motivate them enough, then that player is probably not going to develop in the way that I think they should develop. And that means it's going to be hard for them to get playing time. And then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Absolutely.
You know, coach doesn't love
Absolutely.
me. Coach doesn't pay enough attention to me. So I'm not going to try hard. And the more they don't try hard, the more I don't pay attention to them. And the more I don't pay attention to them, the more eventually they're just going to work themselves out of the squad. So I know it's a little bit harsh, but that was my joke of an answer that kind of not a joke. Yeah, motivation needs to be intrinsic, not extrinsic.
Which is very, it's more challenging. That's why I think a lot of coaches are struggling, because the whole world that they live in with social media, it's all external validation. And, you know, thinking about players who make a post and then delete their post 30 minutes later because they didn't get the right amount of likes, and they think that that reflects poorly on them. Again, knowing the psyche of the player that we work with in the college game is crucial. I mean, coaching is about human development, and knowing the humans that you're working with, like I said, it can turn into the competitive advantage for you as a coach, or it could be potentially your downfall as a coach. And I think the motivation piece, at the end of the day, humans learn best when they're having fun. Every player that I work with, they want to have autonomy over their life. At the end of the day, they really do. I think there's maybe some murking of the water, or whatever the expression is. You kind of have to help them peel back some of the barriers that are there for them, and help them recognize those barriers and how to remove them. But at the end of the day, the players of this generation, they're motivated. They want to do well. They want to be accepted within a group. And being accepted within the group means that they, if the culture is and energy of the team is good, a lot of them are going to want to fall in line with that. A lot of them don't want to fight that. I think when there's a lack of clarity, a lack of communication, a lack of consistency with from and everything with our program culturally, I look, it stops, the buck stops with me. If I want our players to lead with vulnerability, if I want our players to look within the mirror, I have to lead by example here. If I expect that, well, what I do is I do that. I show them this is the way, this is the expectation, and it is on each of them. It's a choice every day. Are you going to add to the team culture, or are you going to take away from the team culture? And again, the motivation piece, I think helping them start to really understand the value of the internal motivation, the delayed gratification, because it's so instant gratification all the time. I'm so proud of our freshmen, not just our freshmen, I'm so proud of a lot of our players this year who didn't see significant game time. You know, only maybe got some garbage time minutes in some games that we were up. And of course, I tell them, every minute you get on the field, you earn. I'm not here to run a charity. I'm not just giving minutes because I feel bad for you because you didn't play 4 games in a row. You have to continue to work hard in training and earn those minutes. But our players here really have an incredible amount of self-awareness done. It is so motivating and inspiring for me as their coach, because a lot of them take accountability. They're like the antithesis of all the things that you hear the stereotypes about this generation. They're humble, they're hardworking, they're not entitled. I'm so grateful to work with this group of players here. And again, I think that's why we had the heck of a season that we did, making it all the way to the Elite Eight, as a team that was projected to finish fifth in the conference.
And not to blow any smoke up whatever, but this does come from the top, Stephen. So this says something for you and your staff and how you set the tone. And it's pretty wild that you guys did what you did, by the way, because, and I'm sure the last coaching staff did a good job recruiting and
Absolutely.
left you in a good position, because you got hired very late, didn't you?
Yeah, basically interviewed in early May, and I'm glad you mentioned that, Don, because Matty Moon, our previous coach, they won. They were a fifth seed that won the conference tournament the year before. They're upset, and I think so that's our next progression as a team, is going from the underdog to becoming now the top dog. We finished the season 10th in the nation, finishing in the Elite Eight. We got upset in the first round of the conference tournament as a number one seed. It was unfamiliar territory for our group and for me as a coach, because I mean, you can go and look at my records at MSU Billings. It's the first time as a coach that I've really won. And so I think that, I'm the team I coached this year was 100% recruited by Coach Matty Moon, and she left an awesome team. She left the program in great standing, won the season before, went to Iowa as an assistant coach. She did very well here, and it was a solid foundation that I stepped into. And I'm very grateful and appreciative that they accepted me very early on, and we basically worked together to bring the best for the program. And the best for the program this past fall was making it all the way to the Elite Eight, which was amazing.
Yeah, but this does, and what I wanted to talk about and get your take on is the role that a coach plays in the team culture. You touched on it a little bit, but in the really difficult position you came in, getting hired after spring, basically things were over, and the girls are going into summer. I mean, they don't really know you, and now they've got to come in, and I'm sure there were some really nervous girls, wondering how their season was going to go. And there might have been one or two that were upset that maybe got more playing time under the previous coach than they got under you, because you've got decisions to make. But how did you manage that transition phase?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think the number one thing that I knew coming in is I needed to build connection very quickly. When I was officially announced to the team, it was early June. Everyone was home for the summer. I was in Denver. I was finishing out the job there. I mean, I didn't move full time to St. Louis until a couple of weeks before the season started. So over the summer, just doing individual FaceTimes with them, giving them a set of questions that we were going to go over. Every player got the same set of questions, about them, who they were as humans, but also their role within the team, the experience that they had with the team previously, what they felt worked well within the group, what they'd like to see change, what, if anything, needed to be stopped. And I really utilized, I mean, it was just information seeking from me. It was really just getting to know the each individual, and then of course, what are the major themes that I'm hearing across the board? And that really helped guide me coming into day one of preseason. Here's kind of the expectations. We co-create our guidelines and expectations here. I think that was another important piece of it. How do you get collective buy-in? Part of our preseason is breaking the team into groups, kind of trying to even them out grade wise. So it's, you've got a set of freshmen, sophomores, juniors, seniors, and like they take a topic. What are your expectations of teammates on the field, in training, in games, off the field, culturally, in the classroom? And at the end of the day, Don, they would be saying the same things that I would say if I were to create, quote unquote, rules. But the fact that it is them creating that and there's a co-creation piece, I just feel like it really helped right away the group align with each other. And then I also just knew as a head coach coming in that I had to bring clarity and clear instructions as to what I was looking for and what I needed and what we needed as a staff from the team and what they needed from each other, and not really budging on that. And in difficult moments at the start because, again, we had 28 players on the team. Everyone has their own goals, their own expectations. They have their own egos, of course. But when things went drifted away from what we had kind of co-created in that first week, just making sure to address that early, being very honest with that individual or individuals, and then honest with the team about, hey, this is a decision that was made. Here's what we considered, and here's why. And now we move on. And I think the players of this generation, they need information. Successful culture is trying to eliminate as much gray area as possible because we as humans, we're going to fill that gray area with the most negative of thoughts. And so, as a coach, if there's a lot of gray area, the players, especially those that might not be playing or not be playing as much, or like you mentioned, Don, played a lot under the previous coach, but now they're not seeing those same minutes, or they have to almost, it's a blank slate, which in a lot of ways is good, but also in a lot of ways can be very scary. And yes, they were very nervous about a new coach coming in and what that was going to be like. But trying to bring clarity in all things where they might not agree with everything that we do, but they certainly understand the why behind it. And then we progress and we move forward and we listen to each other. I listen to them and they listen to me. I take the information in, I summarize it for them, and here's the plan. This is what we're going to do moving forward.
Do you when you talk about creating a team culture and you talk about the coach leading in creating the team culture, it's all good, that's great, but that's really that's vague. It's very vague in general, and I know it's going to differ for every coach. What would you say your top two or three specifics are that are non-negotiables with how players must behave or respond or what did your players come up with as the top two or three non-negotiables when it comes to team culture and what the expectations are of the individual team is?
Yeah, that's great. I love the word non-negotiables. I'm a big Arsenal fan. I know Arteta speaks a lot about his non-negotiables. For one is the team comes first. And at the end of the day, we all have to put our egos aside. If it's good for the team, then it's good. Full stop, period. And that means that it might not be best for you in that moment. But the team comes first. Another one is hard work is best.
Can you give us a couple of examples
Yeah, of
in
course.
under that category?
Yeah, I think we introduced a travel roster to our team this fall. We had some day trips. We again very early on when we have day trips, we're driving 2 hours playing a game and coming back. We travel everyone, but when we have our few overnight trips, we are going to travel. Our number was 21 players,
Out of
and
how many? How many
we
players
had
on your roster?
28 on the roster.
Okay.
I decided to do 21 in an effort to drive competition, that making a travel roster was not just a given or a guarantee. So in this example, that's seven players. Some of them were injured and were not going to be able to travel, but oftentimes at least four or five could. If those players, and we had a staff member stay behind and train them on the 2 or 3 days that we were gone, those players are allowed to be frustrated, disappointed, and upset that they didn't travel. I don't want anyone on our team being like, oh, good, I'm glad I didn't travel. Then you shouldn't be on our team because you're not competitive.
Right.
But if they show up with horrible attitude to those sessions when the team is gone, they have to put the team first. And that means they've got to show up, they've got to train hard, they've got to bring a good environment. And of course, at the end of the day, they're only helping themselves. They're helping themselves get closer to what they want, which is to make the travel roster next time. If they phone it in, they got poor attitude, they kind of go through the session 50%, they're ne negative Nellies. It hurts them and it hurts the team and it hurts the players in that group. And so for me, that was you asked for an example about how to put the team first. And I'll tell the players, I might not, we might as a staff, the 21 that we took, we made the best decision we could at the time to help the team win. Doesn't mean that it was the perfect or right decision. There could be, yeah, maybe there was a 22nd player or 23rd player that, yeah, actually, they probably should have traveled. But at the end of the day, we make difficult decisions. It's never personal. We're doing it for what's best for the team. And you can also show in the time off. And then when we come back from our trip and we're training again collectively as a group, why it was a mistake for us not to travel you.
Good one. Yeah, good example. And then, so the second one.
Yeah, that hard work is basically an expectation. You know, I think sometimes players like, Coach, I've been working so hard. Why am I not getting playing time? It's like hard work is what is required to be on our team. So that is like the baseline is you've got to bring it every single day. You've got to come to training ready to work. We will use the phrase, you got to give 100% of your 80. I think it's important to recognize, Don, that we are all humans as well. We were training at 6:15 in the morning most of the fall, really early sessions. Give 100% of your 80. Whatever you have to give on the day, you got to bring the best that day. And that basically do not use that you're a hard worker to advocate for yourself. That is a guarantee
I
within
love
the
that. A lot of players
program.
do that. I work
Oh,
so
absolutely.
hard, so I deserve.
Yeah.
Yeah. Using another sport, that's like saying, as a basketball player, I can dribble the ball really well. It's like, are you kidding me? That's how you move the ball. What do you expect? It's a basic bare minimum, and I love that. That's one of your bare minimums. That's just a minimum expectation. It's not a pat on the back. I deserve an award for working hard.
Correct. And I think
I
that's
like that.
where trying to teach the delayed gratification that you're working hard now, let's say as a freshman, and you maybe didn't get the minutes. I keep saying that our freshmen did very well. We have juniors and seniors who didn't play. You working hard now, what is that setting you up in the future? What does that look like? You want to improve in this area. Let's work at that. That's going to give you the best chance to get on the field. But at the end of the day, it's a competitive program. We have two or three players in every position that are at a Division II elite level. So I think those two, and then I mean, it's another non-negotiable is just the care piece that you do represent the UMSL women's soccer program, whether you're in the uniform and the game or at practice or you're in the classroom or you go to the local grocery store here in St. Louis, whatever you do, you're always representing our program. And so caring for yourself and what that looks like, caring for your teammates, because again, we want an environment where people feel loved, where people feel included, where people feel valued. That's what every human being wants. And every person in the program, from head coach down to our support staff, the captains, the seniors, the freshmen, they all have a role to play in the care that they show to one another and the environment that they cultivate through that care.
Yeah, I love it. Are there any other non-negotiables that you can think of that the team came up with, or were those set your basic foundation?
I think those were the basic foundations. I mean, our core values are trust, commitment, care. And so, that's a big piece of again, culture is a buzzword. Anyone can write on a sheet of paper, hey, let's be a family, let's all get along. But it is the day-to-day interactions. And I think again, important role that I have is okay, our values are trust, commitment, care. How do you build trust? Well, trust is something that is not built overnight. It is built through the small interactions, the small efforts over time really build trust. What does commitment look like? We want to win a national championship next year. What is it going to take from a commitment level for us to get there? And then I know I mentioned the care piece, already, but how naming the values is one thing, but attaching action and character to those values, that's the day-to-day. We have core value rocks. So legitimately, because I'm going to go into a team meeting here in a little bit, like legit rocks that have our core values. And
Oh, cool.
this is our first time of this semester doing it. So the coaches start the activity. So like our job as a staff will be one coach will take trust and why we're giving it to this player, commitment and care. Once that player has it, every week we're doing Team Culture Fridays. It's just the time that worked with scheduling for everyone to be there. So we do it at the end of the week. Once that player has that rock, they have basically a week to decipher and, okay, I have the commitment rock. Who, what teammate of mine is really showing that this week? And then
Oh,
they
wow.
pass it along. And again, it just goes back to that player driven. It starts with the coach just to get basically the ball rolling. And then at each week, it just gets passed throughout the team. And again, I think what our team has done so good with Don, and why I think our environment is as special as it is. It's very rarely ever like the starters that get the rocks or the players, scoring the game-winning goals. It's in the details. It's in the players who are showing up on a day-to-day rain or shine, whether they're getting the minutes or not. Because again, we want to try to detach their value just to playing time, because on a roster of 28, 11 start. I mean, we're never going to have a game where all 28 players play in one game.
Right,
It's just not
right,
possible. I mean, maybe 20 max are getting in a
right.
game, and that's still eight players not playing. So how can we, like, your value is not minutes, your value is in your character and what you bring to the team and how you move us forward and help us create the environment that we have.
I love that so much, man. It's something that I preach to my own, even my own son when he was playing, that soccer is something that you do. It is not who you are. And I think it's so vital for players to understand that, look, even if you're playing at the D1 national championship level, the odds that your life is going to be a career in your sport is infinitesimal. It's so small. And even if it you do have a short window of that career in sport, what do you do when that career is over with? That's the majority of your life. So these values that you're talking about, and players not falling into a depression because, well, I was a soccer player and that's over. So who am I now? I don't know who I am. Do I bring any value to the world? Is something that
Absolutely.
parents can work on early, coach can work on early, and then certainly as a college coach, people don't understand that haven't done it, but you're ushering your players into adulthood. You are, I know some coaches don't want to be this and don't want to think about this, but what I hear you describing is a form of parenthood, of helping those players, standing at least next to them so that when they stumble, you can help pick them up and keep pushing them the right direction into becoming valuable members of our society,
Yeah,
not just
absolutely.
soccer.
Yeah, absolutely. I think very early on in my career, my first true quote unquote season of coaching, 1A high school boys soccer in Western Maryland. I'm heading to my very first scrimmage, and there's a sophomore on the team, Austin Campbell. His grandmother comes up to me and says, "Austin doesn't have a male figure in his life. You kind of need to be that person for him." And I'm like, I'm 22 years old. I'm thinking, "Oh man, this is awesome. I'm a varsity boys coach. I'm the best thing smoking. Like, this is great." And I was like, "Oh, this is not about me. This is about helping people, believe in themselves and helping people, helping kids." Because at the end of the day, I mean, our players won't want me to describe them as kids, but they're still very much kids, even at 22 years old. And helping them really find themselves, find what drives them, find their special qualities that make them different from their peers. That is the true calling, at least for me. That's what I believe in. Of course, I'm competitive. I want to win. I want to win a national championship here at UMSL. But at the end of the day, if my players only remember me for teaching them the game of soccer, I believe I have failed at my job.
Yeah, and it sounds like Stephen that that's not the way it's going to be. I always say, if you're invited to players' weddings, if you have players talking to you after graduation, that's definitely a mark of the impact that you've had in their life. And I think it's an important measurement to the impact you have in their life. What kind of one of the last questions I want things I wanted to touch on, but leadership, leadership within the team, team-led leadership. What kind of programs do you put in place with your players to develop? Do you have a leadership council? Do you meet? I know some coaches do that, and then they meet with those players, and then those players reach out to the team, because obviously you have 28 players, and I'm imagining, I don't know how big your staff is, four maybe, three. There's no
An all
way that
part-time,
three or four people can be with 28 players and make each player feel special. It's just, it's impossible. And with all of the requirements. So what do you do with regards to developing leaders and your leadership group, your captains, or
Excellent.
beyond that?
Yeah, so in the fall we had the team vote for captains. We ended up with two seniors and one junior. So the two seniors have graduated. So this spring, with our one returning captain, basically has a slot already on the leadership committee. That's what we're going to start this spring. So actually they're going through that voting process this week in their initial IDP meetings with me. We essentially gave them a document that again goes through here are our values, here's how they look, like what players do you really lean to and trust. Who's inspiring you to do more and be more? And I'm having them vote for one player in each class. So they must vote for a freshman, they must vote for a sophomore, they must vote for a junior. And then we have kind of an open class. They're voting for four people. That last vote can essentially be someone from any grade or any class. And we will tally that up as the week, as next week finalizes, and we'll announce the leadership committee to the team. We're probably looking at four to maximum six players. I think it's really important, and I want the players to understand why I'm having them vote for freshmen and sophomores is leadership development. And how are we, first off, the freshmen living in Oak Hall on campus, they have a different experience living in the dorms than someone that's off campus that lives maybe 15 or 10 minutes from the school. So I think getting their input is super important as well. But again, leadership development, we do describe leadership. I took this from Simon Sinek, who has a book called Leaders Eat Last. It's a big book on philosophy of servant leadership is caring about the person to the left and to the right of you means you're a leader. And so we do, I mean, I use the word leader with every player within the team, and everyone has to obviously lead in their own authentic way. What's so awesome about our team, Don, is I mean, I've only done about maybe eight or nine meetings now, and we already have three or four different freshmen, two or three different sophomores, three or four different juniors. So there's a lot of players within the team. Like, I find that to be very positive. If it was only one or two players that were consistently being voted, okay, great for those players. They're clearly going above and beyond. But are we not doing a good enough job developing leadership across the board and across the group? Because as you know, with college soccer, I mean, we lost seven seniors, and it's like that. They're on the field in the Elite Eight game, that game ends, we do an end of year meeting, and then that is it. And we move on. And so how are we developing the next group of leaders? So yeah, so we'll do a leadership council or leadership committee this spring. It'll be my first time doing it with the group. Hopefully all the players, whether they're in the committee or not, view it as an enriching experience. And that would be something that we would talk about as a staff. Do we keep that going into the fall? Do we vote for captains in the fall? Do we re-vote? I think everything should always be open for interpretation or open for review. Did this work? Did we get out of this what we wanted? How can we make this better? And again, I think it's important to have the players as part of that process. I tell them every time, I'm going to take your feedback in. It doesn't mean we're going to do it because there's 28 of you. And if I did everyone's feedback, we'd be all over the shop. We'd be changing what we were doing every other day. But I use that as information. What are the common themes coming out? And how can we improve and enrich the experience that they're having?
So your players 100% so your players vote for the captain. That's, the coaches have no feedback in that. So what if the
Good
players
question.
choose what if
The
the players choose somebody who the coaching staff says, really?
So what I tell them is at the end of the day, the coaches will have the final say. What is a good metric and measuring stick for us is we as coaches all know who we think the captains are or who are the leaders that we really see. And is there alignment there? Because if I'm thinking this player X is going to be the captain and nobody votes for them, I'm like, okay, what am I missing? Maybe this
That
individual is acting
happens.
a certain way around the staff. And we see them in some light, but again, we're with them, what, 2 hours, 2.5 max out of the day. So I think it's always a good measuring stick with the leadership committee that we're doing. I'm having the coaches, the staff, the support staff, our strength and conditioning coach, our athletic trainer, they're voting as well because they also around the team a
Oh,
lot.
that's a good idea. I never thought about that.
And they see the team in a different light as well. They see the team
Good
when the
point.
coaches are not around. And again, we're at D2. I don't think anyone across the board of college athletics ever gets paid what they deserve, but certainly at the Division II level, we've got people working for cents to the dollars. And how do you also make sure that those individuals feel included, feel like they're a big part of the team? It all comes back to we want every individual interacting with our program, pouring positive energy towards it, moving it in the right direction together, because that is what is gonna, that's what's gonna be required for us to reach the ultimate goal of that we have of winning a national championship.
I like that. I like that approach. Honestly, I spend time on this because it's one of the areas I struggled with as a coach. I mean, some years we got it spot on. And that what I noticed is when we got the leadership spot on, got the right guys, right players, we won. Without
Absolutely.
a doubt, we won. I mean, the team would pull off amazing things. When we got it wrong, it was a dis the whole year was a disaster when we got it wrong. And so it's something that is I've always said this. I've just never got it right how to do it. But if the players are driving the discipline from within, the coaches don't have to do much disciplining. And it's so important that if it's player driven, the players respect it more. And especially if it's the better players. How do you deal with it if the leadership isn't the better players? At least on the guys' side, it'll never work on the guy's side. You can't have a player who's not a stud as a leader. It will never work. But on the women's side, it can work a little bit, but there's still a sense of, I mean, you can't have a kid who's getting no playing time being one of the leaders, can you?
It's a great point that you make, Don, and I will counter it with, when I was at MSU Billings, we had a player, Rachel Lithgow, who unfortunately had essentially what was we didn't know at the time, a career-ending ACL injury that happened her sophomore year that ended up with like 4 or 5 surgeries, fighting so hard to try to come back, and it just never happened for her. We would do captain votings, and Rachel every single time was voted into had the most or second or third most votes. And so that was an eye-opener for me because, of course, on guys, it's like, who are the captains? Well, typically they're the best players on the field. And on the women's side, I think there's a lot more nuance to it. I think there's a lot more of that the best players aren't always viewed as the leaders, and leadership again can be described in so many different ways. There's never one cookie cutter version, and I think at the end of the day, any sort of leader just needs to be authentic. They gotta be themselves. If they are trying to be someone that they are not, everyone else around them can sniff that out and knows that, and you lose respect. And I think Rachel was, I mean, what a caring teammate, what a hardworking individual. The team saw how she responded to every setback. And I think that's why a lot of the players did end up voting for a player like that. So here at UMSL, the three captains that we had this past fall, they were all three starters. It'll be really interesting to see how that progresses. You certainly need someone on the field with the armband. Absolutely. But I really think across the board, and it doesn't mean that it's right. And your definition of right, I mean, at MSUB with Rachel, it wasn't her fault, but we won 6, 7 games. It's probably the max we got. But you just try to make decisions as a coach that you feel are best for the team. And when it goes well, evaluate it. When it doesn't go well, evaluate it, and don't hide from when it doesn't go well or place blame. I was born at Georgetown University Hospital. We're big Georgetown basketball fans, and so John Thompson Jr., the coach, the famous coach there for the Hoyas through the 80s and 90s. His book, he He talks about a loss that he had to North Carolina and Dean Smith led team. And he's talking to Dean Smith out of, after the game. And Dean Smith tells John Thompson, "You're going to be all right in this profession because when things go wrong, you don't blame the players." And I really believe in that philosophy. It doesn't mean that I'm a punching bag that is going to take 100% accountability, that it is a one-way street and you can walk all over me. Absolutely not. But when things do not work out the way they are intended, you have got to look in the mirror and you've got to take ownership and you've got to work to get better. And that's to me what helped me this year, probably have the most connection and most closeness with the team is I took a lot of the lessons learned from MSU Billings, from Nevada Reno, from Denver, my experiences, and you just again try to be the best version of yourself for the players and hope at the end of the day it works. You got to get lucky. This year we had it was the right storm of my personality, my culture, what the team needed, it just clicked. And hopefully it can continue to click in year two and beyond.
Man, that's I couldn't think of a better way to wrap this up. I really appreciate you being with us. I know you got to head out, get ready for your team meetings, so I won't keep you too much longer. But thanks for coming on with us. I know this is going to help some players and some parents and hopefully even some coaches that listen to this. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, Don, thank you so much for giving me the platform, the program, to talk about the program and our student athletes, both past and present. I got some name drops in there. Hopefully they're all okay with that. If not, maybe they won't listen. But I really appreciate, Don, you taking interest in our program here and what we're doing and appreciate your time.
Thanks, Stephen. Appreciate it.
All right. Have a good day, Don. Thanks.
So one of the topics that people come up with all the time that we have to respond to is the fact that in soccer, we're seeing older players come in, older freshmen, 19-year-old freshmen, 20-year-old freshmen come in. And that's because those players have taken a gap year and they're often more successful in college than the 18-year-olds. It's really tough. And if you find yourself in that situation, or you know a player in that situation, it is why we have created gapyearsoccer.com. So gapyearsoccer.com, if you go and you apply, we can get the information in and you can talk to one of our staff about soccer opportunities in Spain for a gap year, or in England, or in Germany for a gap year, to take a year out to develop emotionally, mentally, technically, tactically, physically, have another year of development. So go to gapyearsoccer.com, fill out an application. One of our staff members will be in touch.